then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's June 16th, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons, on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune, and hurrah, my voice for freedom, is the rising of the moon.
All right, this week, for various reasons I won't get into, namely that there have been some things happening today which have taken up a lot of my time and effort, I am not going to have time to write out a script for this program, and so what I'm going to have to do is try and ad-lib it, because I do want to kind of keep on schedule here. Just for everyone's general information, the actual deadline for Radio Free Northwest, as far as I'm concerned, is 8 o'clock Pacific time on Thursday night. Now, if the show does not appear on the website by that time and on that date, Thursday, 8 o'clock Pacific time, as far as I'm concerned, the show's late. And by that standard, we haven't been late once during the 15, 16 months we've been doing the show. But I do try to get the show on the air earlier than that, usually sometime Wednesday. It depends on how things go, whether our sound editing guy is available that day, because we have to do that long distance, so forth and so on. But I do generally see if I can get it out on a Wednesday, sometimes even a Tuesday night. But technically speaking, again, just FYI, we're not actually late until after 8 o'clock Pacific time on Thursday nights. Now, as I said, I would like to kind of keep on schedule here. And because the show is done mostly on Monday and Tuesdays, and this is Monday, and things were kind of hectic, and I had a lot of my time taken up by other stuff, I'm going to try just ad-libbing some things here and see if that works. Now, I'm sure many of you caught the latest news in the Edgar Steele case, that being that Ed Steele's defense attorney, a lawyer from Colorado called McAllister, has been disbarred for a typical sleazy act of attorney-like corruption, i.e. embezzling something like $100,000 from one of his clients, which is no surprise, I suppose, since being an attorney is by itself a disreputable profession. But I can't help but wonder if Ed and Cindy Steele were aware of the fact when they hired this turkey that he was under investigation by the Bar Association in his own state, and that he was in danger of being struck off the rolls, which he was immediately after he completed his alleged defense of Edgar Steele. Now, I can't say from personal experience whether that defense was any good or not. I wasn't there. I didn't witness the trial. For all I know, this guy McAllister gave it his all, and nobody could have done anything. I suspect that may be the case. But still, I do find it rather odd that the only attorney which the Steele family apparently was able to get to accept their money, which I have heard whispers was in the amount of like $175,000 they raised for a defense fund, I think it's odd that the only attorney they could find to take the case was one who was apparently facing almost immediate disbarment afterwards. And I also can't help but wonder if Mr. McAllister is going to send Cindy Steele a bill for $175,000, or indeed any amount, for getting her husband convicted on all four counts. I think that would kind of add insult to injury, but being a lawyer, I doubt he's very long on the ethics department, and since he's just been disbarred, that may be the last fee he ever gets a chance to collect. Again, though, it's just one of these funny little odd little things about this case. This case against Edgar Steele has just been full of these weird, strange, unusual, eccentric little angles ever since Steele's first arrest in June of last year. Larry Fairfax testifying to the FBI that he was hired to plant a bomb on Cindy Steele's car, but neglecting to mention to them the fact that he'd actually done so. The whole idea of Edgar Steele, an attorney with 30 years' experience, doing something this stupid, so as to talk to somebody like Fairfax and allegedly try to suborn them to commit a crime, knowing full well that he was thereby placing himself totally at the mercy of Fairfax. The whole lack of a motive. The FBI at first claimed that Steele was trying to hire a hitman to kill his wife and his mother-in-law for insurance money. Then they found out that there was no insurance money, so they changed their mind on that, and they said, well, it was because Cindy Steele had a boyfriend. And then they weren't able to locate or prove that Cindy Steele had any such thing, so that one was tapped out. Then they claimed that Edgar Steele had an online girlfriend, some bimbo in the Ukraine, and he was so madly in love with this girl on the internet that he was going to blow up his wife and his mother-in-law and presumably go to Kiev and sweep this Ukrainian girl off her feet and carry her off back to his castle in Idaho or whatever. It's just, the whole case just reeks of these weird, dysfunctional little loose ends here, there, and everywhere. And this is another one, just one of those odd little things. By sheer coincidence, 2 weeks after Steele's conviction, his defense lawyer gets disbarred. I mean, is it retaliation for having defended Steele too enthusiastically? Was he disbarred instead of prosecuted for embezzlement because he didn't defend Ed Steele correctly? Who knows? Like I say, this whole case is just replete with these strange, weird little angles and things moving in the shade like that. Anyway, moving on to some news I think many of you will find disappointing. Most likely, we're not going to be able to have Access Sally on here this week. Again, I have to say that this show is done mostly on a Monday and a Tuesday, and there are certain Mondays and Tuesdays when she simply can't be here because of her work schedule. Now, because I've been delayed, I may try to see if I can stretch this out and maybe get her in here on a Wednesday so we can have a little chat. And then we'll have to complete the show and get it edited and get it uploaded to the site by 8 o'clock Thursday night. That might still be possible. I don't know. We're just going to have to see. I hope so, because I know that Access Sally is becoming very popular on the show. And I know she's starting to develop a fan base, so we'll see if we can't get her on. Now, another thing I want to comment about real quick. A few weeks ago, Mac, our Northwest immigrant that we had on here describing his own homecoming, mentioned that we had a new immigrant from the East here who has moved in and is looking for work and accommodation, so forth and so on. We're helping him get settled in. I have to report that this gentleman is now employed. It's not the sort of job he was doing back East. It's not really the sort of job he prefers to do, but he will be starting work in a few days, and he will be drawing a paycheck, so that's the first thing taken care of. And now we're all helping him find a place to stay, getting him an apartment, a small house, whatever we can come up with, so that he'll have a place to rest his weary head, so to speak, when he gets off work. And once he's got a job and he's got a place to live, he can settle in and start building some roots in the community here and start working with the NF on various projects. And so again, I say, people, it can be done, because we are doing it. All right, as most of you who've been listening to this program for a while know, I like to periodically run audio clips and other material talking about the history of the movement, our movement, and yes, we do have one. I've run audio clips from people like Father Coughlin and Huey Long and other people, and I recently came across another clip from the late Commander George Lincoln Rockwell. This is a media interview which he did, I believe, in Dallas in 1965, although I'm not sure. But it is, for once, a fairly good, clear recording. So I think you'll be able to get a pretty good idea of the commander's personality and his dialectic style from this.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Tonight's guest is probably the most controversial figure in the world today. He's been called the most poisonous spreader of hate and venom now alive, and has also been called a leader in Great American by many people who listen to him and believe him. He is ex-Navy Commander George Lincoln Rockwell. Commander Rockwell, I understand that you were a Navy fighter pilot in both World War II and Korea, and you won a lot of decorations in combat. Yet today, you call yourself the Commander. I believe that's the correct title. You're leading a group of young men who call themselves Nazis. Now, how do you explain this? How can you call yourself Americans and also Nazis at the same time? Well, there's a lot of answers to that, but the first and most important one is that being a Nazi doesn't make you a German any more than being a follower of Jesus Christ would make you an Israeli, because Christ was an inhabitant of Palestine. The main reason that we use the name is because the Nazis first advanced and fought for the idea that the white race is a master race, a super race, which was able to build white Western Christian civilization. And I think most Americans understand and believe that. There's nothing wrong with that idea. It's a simple truth. And those words, master race and super race, have been smeared by our enemies, the Jews, who are promoting race mixing. And I think it's insane for us to allow them to divorce us, to divide us from the man who first fought for those ideas and the brave men who went down before the communist hordes fighting for it. You must remember, I originally left Brown University in 1940 to go fight Hitler, because they told me that he was out to conquer the world and we had to save Poland and Czechoslovakia and so forth. So what I did was I went out and I helped to murder millions of my fellow white Christian, anti-communist, racist German brothers in order to help save a criminal gang of atheist, murdering, anti-Christian, communist, Bolshevik race mixers who now boast that they will bury us and who are doing it. I might ask you, who has Poland now? Poland that I went to save. And who has Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Romania, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, East Germany, Albania, Yugoslavia, China, North Korea, and now even Cuba, 90 miles away from our own coast? Actually, we got into World War II because Franklin D. Roosevelt pushed us into it with a phony, planned attack and the murder of over 3,000 American boys at Pearl Harbor in order to help save Russia. The evidence for that Pearl Harbor disaster is now all in and has been written by American admirals with an advance, or rather a foreword, by Admiral Nimitz himself. There's no question about it. We were pushed into World War II in order to stop Hitler's anti-communist, pro-racist war against Russia. If we hadn't been pushed into that war, there would now be no Cold War, there would be no arms race, there would be no communist colossus, there'd be no communist riots in the Congress, or any place else. We would not be facing the prospect that the so-called conservatives are always putting out. I'd rather be dead than red, and we'd have to decide between being dead and red, because there would be no reds. There would be nothing but dead reds. Hitler completely wiped communism out of Germany. He put all the communists in the concentration camps. That was the end of them. Finally, I found out that the same gang that pushed us into war with Russia is the same gang that is now preaching peace and coexistence right now to us. And in fact, they invite Khrushchev to the White House. It's the same gang that smeared and destroyed and lied about Father Coughlin. They lied about Henry Ford and smeared him. They lied about and smeared Congressman Rankin, Martin Dies, the great Senator McCarthy. They lied about the Douglas MacArthur, and they put him in the ash can of history. They got him fired. And now even General Walker and even Robert Welch, who has done very little, really, compared to some of these other men, even these people are lied about in exactly the same way as they lie about Adolf Hitler and me. Anybody, in fact, who fights communism and race mixing and actually hurts the enemy is called a Nazi and a fascist. All you have to do is look through a few years' copies of the Communist Worker newspaper. And I might point out also, long before I came into existence, a lot of right-wingers claim that my job is to get these people smeared as Nazis and fascists. Well, all you have to do is look at the Worker newspapers. In fact, a lot of the other newspapers, which follow the Worker line, like the Washington Post many times, and you will find them calling Senator Joe McCarthy a Nazi and a fascist long before anybody ever heard of Rockwell of the American Nazi Party. I think it's simply time for us to quit being afraid of these smears, these communist Jewish smears. It's time to spit in their eye. And if it means that you are a Nazi and a fascist because you fight for a white Christian America who will have no part of communism and race mixing, well then, by George, let's be Nazis. What we've got to realize, I feel, is that there is a war, an actual hot war going on right now in which people are being killed between the white Christian West and the Jewish-led massed millions of the rebellious colored hordes of the earth who are rising to slaughter and murder white people under the banners of communism. There isn't any middle ground. There is no place for conservatives and liberals in this thing, because it's a battle of terror. People are being slaughtered all over this world right now by the communists. They have no idea of arguing their way to power. They do it by terrorism. And you simply can't fight them with petitions and pretty words. You are either for the white Christian West
or you are for the black communist slave world under the leadership of the Jews. Now, Hitler, Adolf Hitler, was the first man to actually beat communism and beat it to death and drive it out of Germany. And for doing this, the same gang which destroyed MacArthur, and lies about these men, keeps telling the same kind of lies about Adolf Hitler. The whole South, the whole U.S. South, certainly knows how they get lied about all the time, in the press and the TV and so forth. And yet many of these same Southerners who know how they're lied about will persist in believing the steady Jewish propaganda put out by the Jews about Adolf Hitler, by the same people and the same kind of lies. I simply can't understand this. Adolf Hitler fought the first major battle in the world race war that we are facing. And he fought for the white race and against communism. And I think we are crazy to be suckered into believing and spreading the Jews' lies about him for the benefit of communist Jews and Negro criminals. I think that it's about time we recognize that Adolf Hitler was the foremost savior, the political savior of the world for white, Western, Christian civilization against the communist, atheist, Bolshevik race mixers who have almost conquered the earth.
Okay, we're going to take our first music break a little bit early here. Last week, I believe it was, either that or the week before, I can't remember now, I played something called Ship Those Niggers Back, which was an old Hate Nanny song. That version actually was, I thought, Gid Tanner and the Skillet Lickers. It was put out on YouTube anyway by someone called Johnny Reb. I'm not sure exactly who Johnny Reb is, but I do know that he has put out a lot of the old Hate Nanny and 1950s and 1960s Klan recordings and whatnot on YouTube. I'm not quite sure who does this particular number called Coontown, but I'll just say it's by Johnny Reb.
If you smell something funny when you walk down the street, you're in Coontown. You look and see garbage all over the street, you're in Coontown. Up and down the street there ain't nothing but trash, nigger girls trying to get a nigger boy's cash. Then you even see a spook with a big mustache in Coontown. On the corner there's a nigger with a drink in his hand, that's Coontown. Trying to bum a nickel from whoever he can in Coontown. And don't be surprised, you can make a bet, if you go back tomorrow he'll be there yet. He's trying to get drunk, and drunk he's gonna get in Coontown. In Coontown, they seem to think that work is for jerks out of Coontown. He don't do nothing but sleep and doze. He don't wake until his eyes are tired of being closed. It's half a day's work for him to scratch his toes in Coontown. It amazes me to see the way they live in Coontown. They do all the taking while we have to give to Coontown. The nightman worries, the nigger don't care, 'cause at the end of the month, his check will be there. Every nigger earns his living off the old welfare in Coontown. Every nigger earns his living off the old welfare in Coontown.
Okay, some general news commentary from over the past week. Now, I won't give any attribution to this little news article I'm going to read a portion of here, since I don't want anybody screaming about copyright violation. Anyway, it reads as follows, part of it anyway. The Federal Bureau of Investigation is giving significant new powers to its roughly 14,000 agents, allowing them more leeway to search databases, go through household trash, or use surveillance teams to scrutinize the lives of people who have attracted their attention. The FBI soon plans to issue a new edition of its manual called the Domestic Investigations and Operations Guide. The new rules add to several measures taken over the past decade to give agents more latitude as they search for signs of criminal or terrorist activity. Some of the most notable changes apply to the lowest category of investigations, called a quote-unquote assessment. The category, created in December of 2008, allows agents to look into people and organizations, quote-unquote, proactively and without firm evidence for suspecting criminal or terrorist activity. Under current rules, agents must open such an inquiry before they can search for information about a person in a commercial or law enforcement database. Under the new rules, agents will be allowed to search such databases without making a record about their decisions. So, in other words, the FBI is now authorized to just plain snoop on anybody they want. They can check any database, they can pull your bank records, your phone records, they can go through your trash, whatever they want, and they don't even have to officially open an investigation or a file on you. They can just go fishing. Now, there is no real new development here. Now, they've been doing this for years to us, of course, in practice. And what happens is when they want to take it any further, they just fill in whatever paperwork they need afterward, and they backdate it, and they get a friendly judge to sign off on it. Now, I do find it interesting that at long last, the Bureau feels that they can drop one more fig leaf of legality in compliance with the United States Constitution. I think the people in the United States government have finally figured out that they can do whatever the hell they want to do to anybody, and that no one is going to do a damn thing about it. Okay, another interesting article off one of the wire services, and I quote, "A Latino gang accused of attempting a racial cleansing of African Americans in Azusa, California, has been indicted for a federal rights conspiracy, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office. Prior federal cases involving street gangs have included racial violence allegations, but this indictment is only the second time in history that federal civil rights laws have been used against members of a criminal street gang." Boy, when you consider the racial nature of these gangs, that's pretty much tells you what's going on. Anyway, getting back to the article, quote-unquote, "Azusa 13 waged a campaign of hate against African Americans," in other words, niggers, "a two-decade crime spree in which African Americans were harassed and attacked." Okay, now think about this. This Mexican gang has been trying to run the niggers out of their neighborhoods for 20 years now, according to the federal government, and they're just now getting around to doing something about it. This story has actually been reported in the media before, for a couple of years now. Basically, what happened is that some years ago, some nigger gang members, Crips or Bloods or whatever, in some way molested or harmed the daughter of one of the jefes of the Mexican Mafia prison gang. And in turn, the Mexican Mafia ordered a street war against the niggers simply to get them off the same streets and stop them from physically harming and threatening the Mexicans in certain neighborhoods in Los Angeles. In other words, niggers were doing to the Mexicans what they usually do to white people and to each other, and the Mexicans, unlike white people, fought back. Now, this Azusa 13 gang appears to be affiliated with all that. According to the media, these indictments required a 3-year investigation by the FBI and a grand jury. Now, can you imagine if some alleged hate crime had been committed against some poor old nigger or Mexican by skinheads or the KKK? Do you really think it would take the feds 3 years and all kinds of pressure from Latino and liberal political groups to move? Oh, and by the way, it does take two to tango. During all this period of gang-related racial violence, blah, 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 the Crips and the Bloods were striking back and killing Mexicans on the street. Now, has any investigation been undertaken into the issue of blacks trying to ethnically cleanse the same areas of Mexicans? Of course not. We have a black president, well, blackish, and a black U.S. Attorney General who has already said in public that he has no intention of investigating his fellow Congoids for criminal activity. God, I love it when all these squalid little minorities can't play nice together. Well, folks, we're in luck. Axis Sally was able to make it in. We're doing this on Wednesday evening now. I've been talking in the first part of this segment about various news stories and that sort of stuff, but now we can address the earth-shaking crisis that is now affecting Western civilization to the max. Now, I suppose that everybody who's listening to us, unless they've been living in a cave on Mars someplace, will have heard of this latest crisis of democracy that is now shaking the country to its roots and sending the media into a feeding frenzy as millions of people await with bated breath the latest developments in the incredible, fascinating saga of Wiener's Wiener. For those of you who honestly don't know what I'm talking about, you lucky people, some Jew congressman from New York got caught sending naked pictures of himself over his Twitter account. And apparently, in some cases, pictures of himself wearing a bra and panties, among other things. Anyway, he was sending these pictures of himself out to women that he had never met. Anyway, the way he got caught was incredibly stupid, but very 21st century. He apparently intended to send a picture of himself in his underwear, shall we say a close-up, to some nigger girl college student up here in Bellingham, Washington, and instead of sending it just to her, he accidentally hit some kind of send-to-everybody function on his Twitter account, and everybody on his Twitter list got it. This is hundreds, possibly thousands of people, and it included at least several dozen media reporters. Now, significantly, not one of the liberal media people who received this photo of the congressman's bulging Fruit of the Looms bothered to report it or even to contact him and ask any questions. And the only way it came out was that the conservative columnist Andrew Breitbart found out about it through the grapevine and he reported it on his blog. It's turning into the kind of soap opera that Americans really love. Now, his Muslim wife, who's pregnant, was roaming around Europe with Hillary Clinton while all this was going on. And now she's back, and she gets to come home to hubby and ask him what the hell he's been up to while she was away. Wiener has responded with what's known as the Mel Gibson gambit, i.e. he's going to rehab for his addiction to... what? I mean, what would you call sending naked pictures of yourself to women on the internet? Sexting? Cyber exhibitionism? What? I'm sure the psychologist will come up with some kind of weird name for this latest celebrity addiction. I mean, I can see him now getting up in front of some group in this rehab clinic wherever he's going saying, "Hi, my name is Anthony, and I'm a cyber pervert." And all his fellow perverts say, "Hi, Anthony." And Wiener says, "It's been almost 6 weeks since I sent a picture of my kosher schlong to some woman I've never met before in my life." As I said, Axis Sally was able to make it in this afternoon, and she has a reading now she wants to do for us. She's very much into David Lane, and so she will be reading David Lane's final address to the jury.
Hi, guys. I'm Axis Sally, and this is the final address of David Lane to the jury. From the era of Plato, Socrates, and Cato, to that of Da Vinci and Michelangelo, to Locke and Shakespeare, to Jefferson and Franklin, Western civilization has sprung from the creative genius of one kindred people. In the vast panorama of time, this period was but a fleeting moment and a glorious dream. The near future will show what manner of civilization will follow the passing of the white man. How sad and ironic that the American Republic, which was formed exclusively for the preservation and promotion of Western man, became the vehicle through which he was destroyed both here and in his European homeland. For many years, I have struggled in whatever ways were available to a single powerless person to crack the iron media curtain and show my people that those very things which are protected, promoted, and forced upon us by those who today control the affairs of the Western world have destroyed every civilization we have ever built. I refer to such things as infanticide through abortion, a practice which has led to the murder of 15 million babies of my kith and kin, and which is protected by the government and the federal courts. Homosexuality, whose adherents are forced upon us as role models and even teachers of our children by the government and federal courts. And worst of all, the deliberate destruction of our very racial existence. Those who have set out to mix and destroy the last remnant of Western man know full well that no people can continue in existence without a nation of their own in which to propagate, protect, and promote their own kind. They also know that a people who are not convinced of their own uniqueness and value will perish, and that is why I am slandered and destroyed when I show that nearly every improvement in the human condition has come from the fertile mind of Western man. The white man is now a tiny minority in the world, yet he is denied not only a nation of his own, but the integrity of the territorial imperative necessary to his survival. The guilt of those who partake in the destruction of this race of men cannot be adequately described in the vocabulary of mortals. Regarding the prosecutors in this case, I say only that if the perpetuation of power is predicated on perjury, then the U.S. attorneys are as solid as the Rock of Gibraltar. But if nature's laws allow for the concepts of justice or karmic debt, then they walk on quicksand. That this trial even occurred is a violation of every constitutional protection against double jeopardy. The legalistic machinations and chicanery involved in jeopardizing a man for potentially unlimited times for the same offense by changing the legal description of that offense, by changing jurisdictions and so on, are utterly repugnant to the sense of Anglo-Saxon justice, as well as totally contrary both to the spirit and the intent of the Constitution. The mad frenzy of those who now control the federal government of the United States to punish and destroy any white man who resists the deliberate admixture and murder of his rapidly disappearing race is evident. History predicts unspeakable horror for the last generation of white children if I and others who shall come after me are not more successful in awakening our people from their sleep of death. Our task is as simple as it is overwhelmingly important. We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. In the face of that overriding historical imperative, what you do to me does not matter. I am not a brave man. I died the thousand deaths of the philosopher instead of the single death of the soldier. But I willingly sought this destiny, and I will not shrink from it. Soon you will hear from another who will undoubtedly speak of his religious beliefs. Perhaps even at this late date, the power of a religious creed can save Western man, or perhaps divine providence will indeed lend a hand. If not, then those who rebel against tyranny must still accept the consequences with a shrug, or they are neither patriots nor men. I say no more.
This is going to be one of those occasions where I have to talk about some things that I understand I really shouldn't be talking about with the enemy listening, as I know for a fact that they do listen to Radio Free Northwest a lot more religiously than some of our own people. I know there are going to be comrades out there who will tell me that I shouldn't be discussing topics like the Northwest Independence Movement's future plans and needs in public within earshot of people who possess not only the will, but the resources and the power to do us harm. And these comrades have a point. I am well aware of the risk, believe me, and I know I need to pick and choose my words here very carefully to make sure they don't come back to bite me or the Northwest Front someday. But there are things that I need to say to the bona fide, real white nationalist listeners out there and the supporters, the people who are interested in the possibility of a white homeland, the people who've read my novels and like them, you know, our actual constituency. And I have no way of communicating with most of you besides this, because Radio Free Northwest is right now our widest circulating public relations tool. There are more weekly listeners to Radio Free Northwest than there are people on our assorted email lists or regular visitors to our websites and discussion groups. Our Yahoo groups are virtually dead, for example. And so the likelihood that the people who actually need to hear these things will hear them and understand them and maybe, hopefully, even act on them has to be set off against the equal possibility that people who don't need to hear it will pick up on it and somehow use it against us. It's a balancing act. I have to balance the possible benefits of what I say along this line with the possible harm it can do when Mark Potok or the FBI or whoever got a transcript of this podcast landed on their desk. And it's a hard call to make, like I said, but it has to be done. Anyway, here goes. Guys, in May of next year, 2012, it will have been 10 years since I myself came home. The actual date, which will eventually be inscribed on my own homecoming medal, will be May the 29th, 2002. In that 10 years since then, I've written and published some books and a lot of internet essays. I've made some podcasts, and I've put up a few websites. I've written some leaflets. I've written the NF Manual, the White Book. We've created a draft constitution for our new Northwest American Republic, a pretty good one, I think, one that can definitely be the basis for the creation of an all-white society in the future. And finally, we've gotten a trickle of incoming migrants here to the Northwest homeland. But it simply isn't enough. And it isn't happening fast enough, nowhere near fast enough. We are running out of time, and we have got to get this show on the road. We have got to professionalize this party. Things have already gotten beyond the level of what one individual, i.e. I myself, can do. This has to become a serious team effort, and not just Harold Covington's little racial hobby horse that he talks about every week and sends out a newsletter every month and gets older and grayer and eventually keels over of old age or kidney failure or something in his dump. And everyone says, oh, yeah, Harold, he was one of us for a while. Yeah, I used to get his newsletter. He was did some good podcasts, too, wrote some great books. Let's see what's on American Idol tonight. That's what happens to so many of us. Guys, that can't happen to me. It can't happen to the Northwest. We've got to get going here. Now, we're getting there. I'm not kidding about that. There are signs of forward motion. But we're in a race with time and demographics and economics and history. And we are losing that race. As things stand right now, the clock's going to run out and we're not going to be ready. The call to action is going to come, and we're still going to be sitting here behind our computers playing with our keyboards in Wisconsin and Florida and Massachusetts and Texas and everywhere but here, wherever the hell we're supposed to be. The first thing we need to do this right is a proper general headquarters made up of Class A people who live within half an hour's drive of one another and who have the wide variety of personal and technical and political skills that we need. Obviously, we're going to need people with IT skills, for example, keep our computers and our websites up and running, since the internet is our main medium of propaganda. But we're also going to need other people with other types of skills. For example, I've mentioned that we will need a tabloid newspaper, for which we will need an editor and writers, and we will need people with the writing and graphic and production skills to keep it coming out regularly, at least once a month. Now, that's going to be important. We will need the money to print large press runs of this newspaper because it's going to be for mass distribution. I envision the future Northwest Observer to be something like the old Thunderbolt or Truth at Last. Every issue was a complete self-contained introduction to white nationalism. Fields' paper would have a couple of articles on the science of race. It would have a couple of black crime stories. It would have a couple of stories about so-called activism, whatever they were doing, having meetings in rented motel banquet rooms, whatever. But the fact is that that eight-page newspaper, if you picked it up, you got a whole self-contained introduction to the whole white nationalist worldview. We are going to have something like that, that people can actually pick up and read. It's not enough just to tell people to go to a website. We need to give them something to hold in their hand, and the ideal thing for that purpose is a tabloid newspaper, for which we're going to need people with the skills to produce it. And we're also going to need at least a few, well, I suppose you'd call them immigration officers and relocation specialists to create something called the Northwest Agency, similar to the Jewish Agency, which is a branch of the Israeli government and the World Zionist Federation that handles the migration of Jews to Israel. We are going to have to systematize and organize the bringing of new migrants to the Northwest. We're going to have to give them far more help than we're doing right now in locating jobs, housing, employment, educational opportunities for their kids. Give them help in moving. Just the very all the things that we can't do right now, we're going to have to be able to do for more and more people when they decide it's time to get the hell out of their own niggerized neighborhoods and come home to the Northwest. We're going to need local unit leaders, more or less open and public spokesmen, to work for the Northwest Front on a local basis all around the homeland with those support cells of at least five or six Class A people I've been talking about in the past, to back him or her up and make sure that once we start up a local unit, it stays in operation and we don't have this typical movement phenomenon of starting up a unit with a lot of fanfare and then 6 months later, it's all gone because the so-called unit consisted only of one or two people who couldn't take the heat and the guy lost his job and he got all depressed and ran away. We can't have that crap in the Northwest Front. We're going to have to do this right. We're going to have to do it right the first time. First and probably foremost, the Northwest Front is going to need a national organizer, the Northwest version of Commander Rockwell, who will actually lead the party in a political sense. This guy is going to have to be a people person who can deal with all the intricate details of getting actual human beings organized and all pulling in the same direction on the same team. This national organizer is going to have to be a person who, frankly, can put up with all the nonsense and all the crap that the movement dishes out and even thrive on it. I can't do that anymore, guys. I admit it. Now, for one thing, frankly, I am a misanthrope. I don't like people very much, especially movement people. 39 years in the movement will do that to you. I've simply seen too much of my fellow human beings over the past 39 years. Decades of dealing with movement nonsense and just general politically correct nonsense in this filthy toilet of a society has simply worn my patience out. You ain't never going to see me jumping up on a picnic table or a courthouse steps ranting and raving and leading the mob storming the barricades. We need a younger man who is fresh at this and who still has the fire in his soul to inspire him. Now, as I've mentioned before, there is a plan. I haven't been just sitting here twiddling my thumbs and playing with my computer all these years. I know exactly what I want to do. I know exactly how I want to do it. And like everything else, there's no damn reason we can't do it if I can just get somebody participatory in this other than myself and a few other people. Now, here we do get into an area where I really do need to be very circumspect as to what I say. Now, the first step in this plan involves establishing a functioning, professional Northwest Front general headquarters as a first step, in a way based on all these years of past experience in the movement, which have given us a number of textbook examples of how not to do it. Guys, I can't promise you that I won't make mistakes. I'm sure I will. I can, however, give you at least a reasonable assurance that I will not repeat the mistakes of the past. like dressing up half a dozen people in costumes and standing on the street holding signs for the scum to throw garbage at us, and letting the media mock us and the police take our pictures. Now, that much I can promise you we won't be doing. Now, without getting into too many details about this plan, I can tell you some other things we need to avoid. And by the way, for those of you out there who still haven't given up on the idea of an all-America white nationalist party or organization or something, well, don't worry, one day you will. One day you'll get the whole separatist thing. But you might want to give a listen here as well, because these things I'm talking about need to be applied to every endeavor that white nationalists of any stripe apply anywhere. This is the Northwest Front. I'm talking about here how I want to do things and how we will be doing things, but these tactics can certainly be adapted to anywhere else, anyone else. Now, what is the main feature of our enemy? Usually, it's a cumbersome, slow process, a mincing machine that we get sort of just dragged up into and dragged into the machine and slowly ground up into dog food. I've mentioned last week, yes, they can react fast when they have to, but generally they don't. If we want to be effective politically, we have to learn to float like a butterfly and sting like a bee, so to speak. We have to acquire the revolutionary skill of living light, of doing as much as possible with very little, and of being able to up stakes and sidestep whatever the system throws at us on a moment's notice. Now, some of you may be aware that about 14, 15 years ago, an individual whose agenda still is pretty much unknown within the movement filed a baseless and malicious lawsuit against me. One which, by the way, he never had to prove in court, but we won't get into that anyway. The fact is that if I had been tied down at the time with property, with a house, with mortgage payments, with a job that I couldn't leave at a moment's notice, with, frankly, family, I would have been up shit creek. But because I had lived all my life, frankly, on the edge of the law, because I was used to living light, because I was used to not having all the possessions and the material wealth that Americans have, I had the option of simply refusing to play the game, which is what I did. Now remember, America controls white people through our possessions. America and the Zionists control us through our love of material wealth, the material things that we have been taught from birth to crave, through our pack rat instincts that have been instilled in us since we were children, growing up in this completely materialistic society. We white people, we white revolutionaries, have to learn to voluntarily renounce and give up all of those material things that weigh us down and make it impossible for us to live and to move light and duck and sidestep the blows that America throws at us to try and crush us. One of the tactics we are going to have to adopt is that our revolutionary groups, movements, fronts, orgs, whatever you want to call them, must never own anything, especially real estate. Because for a racial group or a personality, and I won't use the term leader because we don't have any, but for someone involved with white nationalism to own a home or any property is like waving a red rag in front of the Southern Poverty Law Center. It's not even really a good idea for someone to become involved in white nationalism at all in any kind of public or leadership position if they do own a house or land or are involved in something that they can't renounce and strip themselves of in order to make themselves less vulnerable. There is a saying that I've adopted in my life, and it's not original with me. It frankly comes from a movie. Surprise, surprise, since that's mostly my socialization for the past 20 years. But anyway, I can't remember what movie this is from, but it's a slogan that alleged criminals used to have, and I think it's a saying that adapts very well to the white nationalist lifestyle if you want to be a real white revolutionary. And that is, never have anything in your life that you can't walk away from in 30 seconds when you see the lawyers coming around the corner. That's because that I've adopted that as my personal motto, that I have been able to survive the kind of assault by the system which has destroyed other groups and other personalities within the movement. And 16 years later, I'm still here, I'm still on the internet, I'm still speaking, I'm still writing, and I am, at least to some degree, still effective. Okay, we can argue about how effective I am, but the fact is that my degree of effectiveness has nothing whatsoever to do with that stupid lawsuit. It failed. I am living proof that people like Morris Dees and the Anti-Defamation League and whoever was behind this bozo that filed the lawsuit against me can be beaten. It doesn't have to destroy you. I know. I'm living proof of that. But the price is that you have to embrace what I suppose might be called holy Aryan poverty, almost like the Franciscans in the Middle Ages. You have to be like Cain in Kung Fu and walk the earth. Maybe that's okay, that's a bad simile, but I think you guys get what I mean. Americans are slaves to their possessions. Americans are slaves to their big houses and their big fancy cars and their timeshares and their toys and their all this sort of stuff, and we have to stop that. It's part of the spiritual awakening that I have referred to on many different previous occasions. We have to change ourselves from within, and one of the major changes that we have to impose upon our own character, one of the major transmutations, you might say, is the rejection of the material world and the material wealth that the United States of America uses to reward conformity, because we are not going to conform. And the United States of America also uses the withholding of these material goods to punish nonconformity. If you are going to not conform in America, as we don't, you have to be prepared for the punishment, the loss of job, of wealth, sometimes of family. This is how America punishes those who refuse to bend the knee. And if you're not going to bend the knee, you're going to have to be ready for it. I'm kind of rambling here, but basically, the type of party that I envision the Northwest Front to become is one that moves and lives and operates light, fast, floating like a butterfly, stinging like a bee, opening one day in Seattle under one name, another day in Eugene, Oregon under another name, the next week in Boise under a third name, that kind of thing. We can't tie ourselves down to property or organizations. Now, on the other hand, we're going to have money. We're going to have literature. We're going to have contact addresses. We're going to have people. We're going to have these communities that I've talked about. And I know that looks contradictory. It isn't really when you think about it. Anyway, I've rambled for quite a bit now, so let's go into a third music break. This song is called I'm a Racist. I'm a racist. The niggas hate it. Okay, guys, I am going to level with you. Doing the show this week has been an absolute dog's dinner. Now, for reasons I won't get into, I have had to produce this week's podcast in short segments and patch them all together, and there's all kinds of other mess going on. Now, this is the final segment of the show where I usually let rip with my end rave or tirade or whatever, when I call down a spirit and I tell you all to get your asses out here. Pull your socks up. Pack that moving van. But it's now Wednesday afternoon, and if we're going to have any hope of getting this show edited and up on the site in time, then I'm just going to have to close by reading off some old stuff. I apologize, but you guys cannot imagine what this week has been like, and my God, it's only Wednesday so far. Now, I mentioned earlier in this podcast the date that would be on my own homecoming medal, which is May the 29th, 2002. In the years to come, after the Northwest Agency and a fighting revolutionary party of Northwest independence are finally organized and have sufficient resources, those who have come home will be issued with a kind of a medal, a commemoration kind of decoration. Now, it may be a cross, it may be round, who knows. On the one side, it'll have probably something Northwesty, an engraving of Mount Rainier, Douglas fir, a bear. Again, who knows. The important part will be on the reverse. Now, on the reverse of that medallion or medal or whatever this commemorative object is, will be your name and a date and a year. That will be the date and the year in which you came home for good. Now, those medals will be handed down from generation to generation of white men and women who will grow up in freedom and safety in this land. Those medals will be the most prized of all family heirlooms. Securely framed and hanging over mantelpieces, kept in safety deposit boxes, bequeathed by name in last wills and testaments, in some cases donated to museums. And the most important thing on them will be that date. Like I told you, mine will say May the 29th, 2002. Now, if I wanted to cheat, I could claim 1994, but that wouldn't be right because I left home again. No cheating will be allowed. No half measures, no half stepping, no vacillation will be honored. The year on your commemorative medal will be the year that you made your permanent and irrevocable commitment to our people's racial destiny. Now, there are those of us already living here in the homeland, some of whom followed Pastor Butler here, who will be able to boast dates on their own medallions from the 1970s, even earlier. Now, the exact beginning of the homeland idea is still kind of a matter of debate. The earlier the date on each medal, the prouder and the more honored that family will feel. When your children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren are shown the homecoming medals of their ancestors, what will their family's date be? Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.